Hello, welcome to this Engelsberg Ideas Worldview podcast series, Reflections on War. I'm Adam Bolton. In this episode, we're going to look at how developments in space are enhancing modern warfare, whether there is the danger of a Wild West culture taking over space exploration and research, and what can be done to contain what is fast, it seems, becoming a free-for-all. I was joined first by Jacob Greer, who's the head of the UK Space Agency, and later by the space consultant Dr. Stuart Eaves of the Surrey Satellite Technology Company, and also Frans van der Dunk of the Nebraska College of Law on how to apply regulation and law to space exploration. We began with Jacob Greer, and I asked him to explain exactly what the UK Space Agency does.
So we are a government agency. We're part of the business department, and we've got three missions: to catalyse investment in the UK space sector, to develop national missions and capabilities in space, and to champion space for the UK public, but also wider internationally as well.
So this is basically a British government agency funded by the taxpayer?
Yes, that's right.
And how does it relate to other international agencies? I mean, obviously, the European Space Agency, our relationship with that has had to change with Brexit.
Yes, we're a key member of the European Space Agency. We still are post-Brexit. The European Space Agency is nothing to do with the EU. The EU has its own separate space agency, which we are no longer part of. But we're still a big player in the European Space Agency. And that's a key part of delivering some of our wider science missions in particular. So the rovers that go to Mars, or some of the lunar, the moon stuff that we do, goes through the European Space Agency. But to develop lots of the capabilities we use every day here in the UK, the public may use for navigation on your phones or other such things, we do that nationally rather than through another partner.
And what about international cooperation with space? I mean, obviously, you know, space by definition is not of this world. I mean, what is the situation as far as international cooperation regulating behavior in space?
Most of it is done through our partners and allies. So we work closely with the US in particular, with Australia, with Canada and New Zealand, as you might expect, but also with countries like Japan and with India, and of course with our European partners. I'll be honest with you though, Adam, international regulation of space is a difficult concept. There is a UN group, the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, which tries to devise the guidelines and the rules to govern how we operate safely in space. But actually, it's not that effective a group in really setting hard rules that people abide by.
So if Russia or China, or indeed the United States or India, say, this is what we want to do, we want to put up these satellites, we want to go to the moon, we want to go to these planets, there's no kind of international discussion about, you know, whether they can do it, whether they should do it.
No, space nations do their own thing. And particularly China, Russia and the US, the big players, they can set their own rules. As their national regulations are what really matter here. There isn't a wider international system to say yes or no in most of these cases.
And is there any plan or, you know, sort of inkling of actually trying to have some kind of agreed international regulation?
Well, there are attempts to do so. There are the long-term guidelines for sustainable space activity, a bit of a mouthful. It's a UN set of guidelines, and that's been agreed by all the UN nations. It took around 15 years to agree those guidelines, and because of the pace of change in the space sector, more and more companies reaching space like SpaceX or Amazon, sending hundreds or thousands of satellites into orbit. Actually, the guidelines have not kept pace with how quickly space is changing. And that is affecting international partners as well as commercial partners too.
So, Jacob, am I right in thinking really that there's two aspects to space? I mean, obviously, it's a vast place, but one is the near Earth, the orbiting, the satellite area. And then the other is space exploration, obviously going to the moon, going to Mars, and the longer term unmanned probes that we're sending out.
Yes, that's right. And the scientific, the exploration side of it, doesn't tend to have too many problems with it. I mean, there have been issues now with Russia refusing to let people launch on their rockets or to support these missions. And so actually that's causing us to change a lot of our exploration plans. The biggest problem is in Earth's orbit. And there's two particular bits of Earth orbit. One is called the geostationary orbit, which is a long way out and goes around the equator at the same speed as the Earth. So the satellite always stays where it should be in the sky, which is really good for important communications. There's another bit of space in low Earth orbit, so below 2,000 kilometres above the Earth. And actually, that is now increasingly congested, contested, and competitive, because there's so many people going there, so many nations putting their satellites up, and so many important uses of space coming from those satellites. Everyone wants to go to the same part. And that's a really growing problem for everyone.
And it's just free-for-all, is it? A competition, effectively, of who can get the satellites up there, including the private sector, people like SpaceX?
Yes, I've heard free-for-all, I've heard Wild West, I've heard other such metaphors as well being applied to it, because essentially, once you get your satellite up there, and once you get something called the spectrum filing, so the radio frequency communications to operate your satellite, once that's yours, it's yours. No one else can go there. And so there is this increasing rush to get and register your satellites, hundreds or tens of thousands of satellites in some cases, to say, this is mine, even if they're not physically present. And that is something that people are trying to get a better stamp on governing.
If it's a lawless space, could you actually just take out someone else's satellite with, you know, no direct consequences, if you like?
There are rules. There was a specific treaty, the Outer Space Treaty from 1967, which shows you how long it's been there for, which says you can't intentionally create debris in space. You can't intentionally harm another object in space. Space has to be peaceful for all of the human race. In reality, there's not much you can do about it if someone like Russia, as they did last year, or China or India before them, want to blast a satellite out of space from the ground and create lots of debris. Beyond just condemning it and perhaps using some of your international diplomatic means, there's not a huge amount you can do about it. And you also tend not to know it's happened until it's happened.
And this is going on, is it? People destroying not only their own old satellites, but other people's satellites.
They tend to destroy their own old satellites as a demonstration to say, look, I can take out a satellite when I want to. Now, the fact that they've chosen to do that on their own satellites previously doesn't mean that it won't be someone else's in the future.
And how are these destroyed? Is it some sort of a ballistic missile or something?
Yes, that's right. A missile goes up. There's not been many of these, let me be clear. There was one last year, one a couple of years before that, and one about 5 years ago. So it doesn't happen all the time. But when it does, it is a big deal because it effectively creates a debris field in a busy area of space, that low Earth orbit I just told you about. And that means that no one else's satellite can launch to that part of space for a number of years while you wait for that debris to slowly come back down with gravity and enable space to be clear again.
And as I understand it, you're involved, or the space agency, the UK Space Agency, is involved with a program to try and clean up the debris. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We try and track the debris to avoid it, avoid colliding with it with satellites, but also to reduce it. So through the European Space Agency, we have a mission to go up and remove a piece of debris. And then nationally, we have our own UK-led mission to go up and remove some legacy pieces of debris that we, the UK, have left there in the course of our space activities. So we're trying to role model and show the world this is good, responsible behaviour in space, cleaning up after yourself. And that's also a market opportunity in a few years, that competitive nature of space. More and more companies want to clean up debris.
And how can you do it? I mean, we're talking about many tons of material, aren't we?
Yes, we are starting small to begin with. So we're demonstrating the missions on satellites that are maybe 50 kilograms, 100 kilograms large. But the technology to go up there, grab a satellite that doesn't want to be grabbed and take it back down is still complicated. And then we hope to move on to the larger and more voluminous piece of debris in time after that.
So you grab the debris and then you, bring it back down to Earth?
Yes, you bring it back down to the atmosphere. And at a certain altitude in the atmosphere, gravity takes over and then it harmlessly burns up in the atmosphere. And then you can go up and collect another piece of debris and take that back down as well.
And these, does this involve manned missions or unmanned missions?
These are all robotic missions. Most things in orbit, apart from the space station, will be robotic in nature.
Right. So that is the lowest level of orbit around the Earth. What about when we get into the geostrategic area? What is the sort of competition there, if you like?
That tends to be more well-regulated because it's such a scarce resource. So there you have a group called the International Telecoms Union, who essentially say you can have this band of spectrum, this radio frequency allocation to go and control your satellites. You know, this is how you do it. And that's how you get a space in the geostationary ring. There's only finite spaces you can have. So that's a bit better regulated because there is this system in place for that band. But even then, the Chinese, just the start of this year, 4 months ago, demonstrated they could send a satellite up there, go and find their old satellite and move it out of the way into what's called a graveyard orbit, where it can't then bash into other satellites or create any new debris. And they showed they can do that with their own satellite. But again, there's nothing stopping them going up and grabbing someone else's satellite and moving it out of the way.
And these satellites are the ones running GPS and weather analysis and all the rest of it, the geostationary ones, is that right?
Yeah, they have a mix of jobs. Most of the time they do communications. So secure connectivity comes at this height as well, this altitude. The GPS tends to be a little bit lower in some cases to give it a quicker speed back to the ground.
And in the lower orbit, what are they doing, the lower orbit satellites? Because we know, for example, I think Elon Musk said that he would put some extra ones up to try and help the Ukrainian war effort.
So they do the sort of commercial broadband, if you will. So a satellite dish on your house rather than a wire, which enables you to have broadband, but also Earth observation. So taking photographs or radar images of the ground. There's a great example from the Ukrainian conflict of all these commercial Earth observation companies providing their data, their images for free. They just send them to Ukraine and say, you want to know where Russian tanks are? Here's an image we took yesterday, and just sending that out for free as well. You can see how that is, that commercial capability is now militarily useful as well.
And are the Russians trying to do anything about that?
I wouldn't know. I don't know at this classification, I have to say. I don't think they are, only because there are so many Earth observation satellites up there from so many companies. To take all of them out would be a very large endeavour. So actually, it doesn't really make sense to try and aim for that part of the capability.
Okay, let's move on. What you're saying at the moment is that there's been quite a lot of saber rattling in terms of capability, anti-satellite capability, but that hasn't escalated into what we'd call conflict or war as yet. Would that be correct?
Yes, I think so. I would say that both NATO and various other nations around the world have now said space is a domain of war. So they've classified it a war fighting domain, which tells you, I think, about how people now perceive space and how important it is to protect your assets in space, understand what's happening there, and potentially do something about it if someone's doing something malign.
Because that was what I was interested in, is looking ahead, and we're probably looking into the, you know, fairly near future, if not the midterm future. How do you think the competition, if you like, is going to turn aggressive, if you do think it's going to turn aggressive in satellite technology?
I think it'll be commercially competitive before it gets aggressive between nations. So you already see commercial companies trying to get into key orbits, trying to get their filings, their registrations done early, also developing new technologies to get up there quicker and move around better, new types of engine, for example. That's the most likely next step. We'll see that continued development. I do think that things like the US ban on testing anti-satellite weapons, which is actually a really strong public statement of how this is not acceptable. If other nations do pick up on that and get behind that and sign up to that too, it starts to alienate people that do want to test anti-satellite weapons. And so there's a really good next step to be had there, if there is the international will, to say blowing things up in space and denying areas of space for all humanity is not on. And following the US leadership, and also the leadership displayed by the UK when we drafted a UN resolution just last year, which has now led to a new working group at the UN about how we can do something about these irresponsible behaviours in space.
You know, one of the things that's been striking about Ukraine, which you've talked about already, has been, I suppose I had an assumption that, you know, if the Russians were going in, they could shut down communications, they could shut down mobile phones, but it doesn't seem that that is a capability at the moment. It's just too omnipresent.
It is. There's too many satellites up there. The one area they have been having some success, and you can see this in open source literature, is on jamming GPS signals, which military and other people depend on for their hardware, their targeting, and various different cases. So they have done that, particularly in eastern Ukraine and southern Ukraine. They have jammed the GPS signals, which has had an effect on the Ukrainian military. But there are ways around that, particularly to look at less developed technologies, so not quite as strong as they are now, but you can do something a bit different there. But that shows you how important space is. The Russians can jam GPS, and all of a sudden, your tanks don't know where to go, your weapons don't know where to fire, you can't perhaps communicate as well with yourselves as you thought you could.
We've also heard that Russian forces have ended up using local phone, mobile phone systems, because they work better than their own encrypted radios.
Yes, I can believe that. I don't know much about that side of it, but it's interesting to see how space, both observing the Russian columns advancing from space or denying GPS, whatever it may be, has become absolutely integral to that conflict.
Now, let's look at the main players. What are, if you like, the ambitions? Let's take the Americans first. What's the next generation of this for the Americans? What do they want to achieve? Clearly, there's quite a lot of transfer into the private sector from the public sector going on in the United States.
So they already have a very strong commercial launch sector. So NASA no longer does its own launches. It buys them in from commercial companies like SpaceX or others as well. They're also trying to get much more involved in the areas of in-orbit servicing. So sending repair robots up to space to repair your spacecraft or move them around or give them more fuel. And then looking further afield, the Americans are leading the way in terms of going back to the moon with men and women. And that's great to see. And that's something the UK is closely involved in and is really an endeavour for lots of nations.
And why? What do they want to achieve?
Well, I think there's a science rationale for that exploration, sort of showing that humanity can do it. There's also the need to go back and start exploiting resources from the moon as well.
Well, mining the moon.
Potentially, yeah, that has been talked about. Mining the moon, mining asteroids as well, to get the precious metals that are there to use somehow. Whether or not that's a near-term thing or that's a few decades hence remains to be seen. But the first step is to get back up there and then see what we can do.
And what about the competitors, if you like, the Russians? What are they focusing on in space competition?
It's tricky to know. They don't tend to publish their plans as well as the Americans do, as you can imagine. The Chinese have. They're aiming for in-orbit servicing as well, so going up there, removing, repairing, changing spacecraft, as well as then putting their own space station up into orbit as well. And they've invited the Russians to join that. So there will be two space stations now, a Chinese-Russian one and a US-European one. Whether or not that happens, considering the billions of pounds that is required to get something like that into space, remains to be seen. But they have announced their ambition to do something very similar to the Americans, but with a different flag on top of it.
And if it comes to competing for resources on the moon, is that basically the Wild West? Whoever can get in there and start digging up the moon can do it?
There's no set of guidelines or rules that tell you how that's governed at the moment, no. So it's a bit of an unknown how it's going to work. I don't think it's quite as easy as getting up there and start digging stuff up and laying your flag on it. I don't think it's going to work like that. But there isn't a set of guidelines that tell you how to work here. So we are operating in a slightly leaderless space.
So it sounds like you think this is going to be, I mean, obviously, historically, commercial exploitation has often gone hand in hand with military conflict. But it sounds like you think this will be mainly a commercial and technological competition rather than one where people actually start fighting each other.
At the moment, yes. If you'd asked me before the Ukraine conflict, I would have said definitely yes, because there's always been good cooperation between, for example, Russia, the US and China on these things. Now, we're in a slightly different paradigm. So it's hard to see actually how we're going to work together to set guidelines for working together and exploiting space resources when we have this level of conflict between the major space powers.
That was Jacob Greer, head of the UK Space Agency, with a very comprehensive account of what is going on in the different parts of so-called space. To look further into how developments in space are contributing specifically to the field of warfare, I spoke to Dr. Stuart Eaves, a space consultant from the Surrey Satellite Technology Company and an expert in this area. Given that Ukraine is the biggest conflict in Europe since the Second World War, when there was nothing like the current technology available, of course, what advances has he observed in the way space is being used in warfare this time?
One of the things that's been really interesting about this particular conflict is the extent to which commercial systems have been involved. So you may have seen reporting of Elon Musk's Starlink communication system being used to provide communications for the Ukrainian forces. And also there's a US surveillance company called Maxar that has a number of surveillance satellites that publish space-based surveillance pictures of the conflict regions. And there have been quite a few pictures from those satellites also appearing in the press. And so because they are unclassified commercial systems, we're finding out a lot more about which systems are being used, and there's a lot more sort of transparency, if you like, about what's going on in this particular conflict in terms of data generated by satellite systems.
Let's just talk about Starlink and Elon Musk. I mean, he gave his or said he was giving his Starlink system basically to support Ukraine. I don't know whether there was any commercial transaction involved, but should we be worried that one man or one organisation run by one man has that sort of power?
I think it has to raise questions, because obviously in this particular engagement, you know, Elon Musk is essentially on the side of the West. You have to wonder what the reaction would have been if he had been, you know, sort of supporting the Russians, whether he would have been allowed to, you know, provide communications in support of the Russian forces. It is very clear that, you know, some of these very rich individuals now have enormous amounts of power and potentially could have even more in the future. So one of the things that Elon Musk's Starlink constellation is about to implement is a series of inter-satellite links between the satellites, which will allow him to move financial data between financial centers like New York and London, for instance, faster than the fiber optic cables can do so. And that provides enormous revenue generating potential on the stock markets. And it'll be very interesting to see how that capability is used and whether, you know, essentially he's allowed to get an enormous amount richer as a result of having that capability in his satellite constellation.
I mean, it's a bit like a sort of modern version of the Sting, I suppose.
It really is quite interesting how so much capability can be sort of concentrated into particular individuals. You know, obviously, people like Jeff Bezos have, you know, plans to do a constellation called Kuiper, which will have comparable capabilities to the things that Elon Musk is doing. But Kuiper hasn't started launching yet. So at the moment, Elon Musk has no competition and a pretty much open field.
And what do we know about other actors, what the Chinese, the Russians, the Indians are getting up to?
Yeah, so there have been plans that have been advertised. One of the processes that you have to go through if you want to start launching satellites is to, you know, sort of register the frequencies that you want to use. We're aware that, for example, the Chinese would like to launch a mega constellation of their own. It's called Guo Wang. And it involves many hundreds of satellites, like some of the Western ones.
And can you look at what each country is doing and sort of work out what they're trying to do, if you see what I mean, what their intention is?
Yes, because the ITU submissions talk about not just the frequencies that the satellites will operate at, but also the orbit at which they'll fly. So you do get some insight into what nations are planning, provided they operate via the ITU rules. And as I was saying, you know, in general, for commercial systems, that's reasonably well adhered to. But there are occasions when military entities, for reasons of security, decide not to, you know, indulge in full disclosure. And that's potentially where the problems could come from.
And in Ukraine, I mean, I originally, you know, just from reading about it in news sources, thought that the purpose of SpaceX's Starlink was to keep the phone system operating for civilians. But I was wrong on that, was I?
I think they've kept the phone systems operating. But, you know, clearly, if you've got an operational phone system, it's not possible to necessarily stop, you know, some sort of military person making a telephone call. Historically, there used to be a distinction drawn between so-called sort of black world military space programs and white world civilian space programs. And in reality, these days, there's an awful lot of gray in the middle, where systems that perhaps were originally launched for civilian purposes are actually being exploited by the military. And there's a reason for that, which is that the sort of pace of commercial development and the amount of money that commercial companies are putting into satellite design means that the data rates that you can achieve through commercial communication satellites and the sort of frequency of revisit that you can get with some of the commercial surveillance satellite constellations are actually ahead of what the military systems are able to do. So the military is interested in the commercial systems because in some cases, the best stuff is in the commercial sector.
And do you think that's going to go on, that the space race is going to increasingly be one involving businesses rather than nations?
I think that's very likely if we stay on the current trajectory, because realistically, people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, you know, if they want to make something happen, it's an executive decision on their part, and then their company executes their decision. Whereas in democracies, especially in the West, you know, you have a chain of bureaucracy to go through, and it's very hard for military systems to be anything like as responsive as that. So, you know, now that the commercial sector has achieved a commercial head start, if you like, in terms of capability, I think it's hard to imagine how the military would claw that back.
And is that still a problem in countries, you know, one thinks of China or Russia indeed, where they're a bit less democratic than we are?
Yeah, so that's a really perceptive question, and something that I know is exercising minds in certain quarters in the sort of military and intelligence community in the West at the moment. So I had a conversation with a friend recently who estimated that, you know, the time it takes for the West to launch a new generation of satellites is probably in excess of 15 years on average at the moment. And they'd done a comparable analysis for China. And because of the, you know, sort of nature of their country, they take executive decisions somewhat akin to commercial operators. So they appear to be able to turn around new generations of satellites in just 5 years. You know, so they're probably starting from a lower base, but even if they are still behind us, they will be catching up very quickly. And there is a very real risk that the aspiration in the US sort of space strategy, which is to maintain space superiority, may have to be modified to, we need to acquire space superiority before we can maintain it.
Where do you see this going? I mean, in the short term, in terms of near-Earth satellite technology, I mean, what's going to happen? Where are the points of tension? Are we going to start trying to disable each other's satellites?
I think in a significant conflict between major space powers, that could easily happen. We've seen potential demonstrated. There is a very real risk, though, that we score a massive own goal by doing so, because if we do create significant amounts of debris, especially in low Earth orbit, we would lose access to the ability to collect data for a whole variety of different, very worthwhile purposes. So obviously, we're very concerned about global warming and climate change and things of that nature at the moment. And if we were to lose access to the orbits that those satellites use, we would essentially lose a lot of the data that we need to combat even bigger problems like climate change that affect everyone on the planet. So I really hope that the military forces that are contemplating aggression against other nations' satellites think very, very hard before they go for the sort of kinetic solutions that they've demonstrated over the last 15 years, because they could very easily be catastrophic.
Dr. Stuart Eaves there on how military aggression in the zone of space could bring catastrophe. But what might stop it? Greater regulation of space with strict enforcement at international level? And what are the prospects for this? And what, if anything, is being done to address the problem? To discuss the issue of legal enforcement in space, I spoke to Franz von der Dunk of the Nebraska College of Law, an expert on space law. I asked him first if it really was a free-for-all up there.
No, that's an impression that many people indeed have, and I probably can't blame them, but it's certainly not accurate. Just to give you the sort of very high-level pitch, there is a treaty going back to 1967, which is colloquially known as the Outer Space Treaty, which is really signed up by everyone, all the big states, not just the US and the Western states, but also the then Soviet Union. Now Russia, China, India, Indonesia, Brazil, you name it. Everyone who's someone in outer space has signed up to that. And that does include a few, granted not too many, but at least a few rules to which everyone should stick. And so far, everyone has stuck to them. Of course, that's no guarantee that they will continue to be so, but it's certainly not a totally unregulated area.
And that's the United Nations auspices, is it?
Yeah, although when you refer to the United Nations, we should be clear that certainly in an area like space, it's ultimately always the individual states which decide. The United Nations can propose whatever they want. If the major spacefaring countries don't agree to that, it doesn't go very far, certainly not in the legal context.
I mean, I know there's a UN Committee on Peaceful Uses right. of Outer Space. Does that mean that inner space, the area where satellites operate, is not covered by any of this?
No, then that's a misunderstanding. Outer space is considered to refer to everything above airspace. So everything basically where there is no oxygen, at least not any quantifiable amounts anymore, which includes the areas where satellite operates. So the further distinction is the nearby outer space, low Earth orbits, where you have many of these satellites flying, and the geostationary orbit and deep space. And that's really outside of the solar system almost. So, but outer space, you know, there is no official borderline, but for the sake of convenience, most people think about an altitude of about 100 kilometers above sea level where that starts. So all satellites orbiting presently certainly are in outer space.
And so if we take the 67 treaty as the kind of baseline, what does that stop countries from doing, particularly in a military context?
In the military context, it does two things. It separates the sort of the endless void of outer space from the actual celestial bodies orbiting in it. And with regard to the first, there is a quite loose regime, so there's not much prohibited. Actually, the only thing which is strictly prohibited is the orbiting or the otherwise stationing of weapons of mass destruction. So it is not prohibited to use outer space as a trajectory for weapons of mass destruction. Thinking about 1967, you can readily see why, because neither the United States nor the Soviet Union, who were, of course, locked in a Cold War at the time, would have ever accepted being limited in the context of their security and their defense policy and strategy to be prohibited from using space for sending a nuclear weapon in the ultimate case to the other country. But what is not prohibited as well is any other weapons. But when it comes to the other part of outer space, the celestial bodies, those are basically very much demilitarized. They're in a much stricter regime. There's no weapon whatsoever allowed, no military maneuvers, no military bases. The only thing which is allowed is the use of military personnel for strictly peaceful and scientific purposes.
So Mars or any of the bodies that are sort of more or less in reach, they simply can't be used for military purposes.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Do you feel that this is going to hold? I mean, I know that some of the kind of case law was built around the International Space Station, for example, which was a cooperative venture. But now we're hearing about maybe the Chinese and Russians building a rival space station. So is the treaty going to hold, do you think?
Well, that's a bit of a crystal ball. It's clear that currently the geopolitical situation has considerably worsened over the last couple of years, which, of course, unfortunately, certainly enhances the chances that one or the other space power might think it would be advantageous to be the first to break this silent or even legal agreement not to do things like that. There is obviously a penalty to be paid, not so much a legal penalty as a political penalty. You don't want to be the first to be seen to violate that, because then, you know, the bear is left out of the cage. And before you start that, you must be pretty desperate, probably. And what also gives me hope that this is not going to happen too soon, in the near future at least, is that the military value of military bases on the moon, for example, which is, of course, the closest celestial body we're talking about, compared to anything you do on Earth, and then also against set off against the cost, is fairly minimal. I mean, if you have $1 billion and you want to harm an enemy, there's much more efficient ways to do that than to do something on the moon, which ultimately leads to damage caused to another state. For the time being, I'm still hopeful we can avoid situations like that.
So in military terms, what is space useful for, either actively or potentially?
All the uses so far have, of course, been in the context of surveillance, monitoring, the fact that we had in the Cold War period two superpowers looking rather suspiciously at each other and wanting to make sure that they would not be taken by surprise. In that context, space technology, space surveillance, spy satellites, if you will, played a major role actually in keeping the peace. And of course, the use of satellites even now in the Ukrainian conflict, that is still very important. And that's obviously a real military power cannot do without that anymore. And then in addition, you now have things like communications and more importantly, navigation. And many cruise missiles are guided by satellites, because it's a little bit more difficult to take a satellite out of the equation if you want to destroy the guidance of a cruise missile as compared to a terrestrial control tower or something like that. So those are the uses, which are either passive in the sense that they collect information and use that to the advantage in a military conflict or a pre-military conflict, or they sustain, they support operations on Earth. So it's not like space is doesn't play a role in warfare, but it is all a supportive role in terrestrial warfare. There is no war in outer space as of yet.
Now, when it comes to surveillance, are there any limits, legal limits on what you can do? Because obviously on Earth, there's such a thing as privacy law.
Yeah, no, the baseline is that there is no such limit, at least not under international law. Of course, states are possible to limit the extent to which surveillance can take place within their own jurisdiction, read when applied to their own operators. To give you one concrete example, the United States is always keen to make sure that its private Earth observation operators do not distribute remote sensing data, Earth observation data on Israel, which are better than what the potential enemies of Israel can get anywhere else commercially, because they have this part of US policy to protect Israel. And part of that is not to make the potential enemies of Israel in the area wiser than they already are. So, but they can do that when it comes to US operators, but they can't prohibit a Chinese operator to do that. And the freedom of outer space basically means that as long as you stay in outer space, nobody, legally speaking, can do anything about it. These privacy laws only start playing a role down on Earth in one territory, one state or another.
And on that basis, would we be right to suppose that if, and we obviously hope it doesn't, this conflict were to escalate, that it would still be one with both sides using digital communications?
Yeah, I hope so. And there will always be something left, because there is already so much communication, in particular in outer space, that it is almost impossible to fathom that that will be, simply erased by military force or even by hacking or whatever. And then ultimately, unless you have a real total maniac who doesn't care anymore about whether he survives himself, there's always this residual, okay, maybe we should stop here. Maybe I should look for a kind of a way out which saves my guts. And that means not going all out in destroying, means of communication. So in that sense, I think we can be pretty sure that it's unlikely that all those communication channels will all be shut down by force, at least.
Looking at where we are, what do you see as the likely areas of conflict, and what laws or agreements would you like to see?
One of the most important ones, if there will be in the time frame of between now and 25 years, realistic possibilities for actually mining the resources on the moon, and those turn out to be indeed of great value, then obviously the risk of competition for those resources is logical. And in the current geopolitical framework, unfortunately, competition may then also lead to conflict with potential military consequences. So whereas my opinion is that currently we should agree on the possibility for unilateral space mining operations as long as within the law, at the same time, the problem is that there is not that much law, which is, of course, a recipe for conflict, because then people, states, have their own idea about what is just. So what I would very much like to see happen in the next 5 years is establish a much more concrete, detailed set of rules on how you should mine. For example, it's probably self-evident that you are allowed to create a kind of a safety zone around your mine just to make sure that no accidents happen, because space, even the moon, continues to be a very, very dangerous place. But what is a safety zone? Is a safety zone of 2 kilometers around the mining site a fair kind of claim? I would say yes, but of course I'm only an individual. Is a claim of 200 kilometers around that is a fair claim? I don't think so. Absolutely not. Somewhere in between, hopefully, we should come to an agreement, and that is what should help us forward in at least minimizing, you can never completely exclude it, of course, but at least minimizing the potential for conflict.
What about space junk clearing up? I mean, on Mars, they've just found, I think, a bit of detritus from a previous mission to Mars.
That was actually the second thing I was going to mention. So you're absolutely on the ball there. The fortunate thing about space debris is that it's a danger for everyone. Space debris does not discriminate. So even if you blow up your own satellite to show your muscle in space, what the Russians and the Indians did very recently, you may also run the risk that it starts hitting your own satellites. As a matter of fact, when the Russians blew up their own satellites half a year ago, just to, you know, to show their muscle in space and that there was still a superpower there, one of the results was that the people on the space station had to take a seat in the lifeboat, because predictions had it that parts of the fragments of that explosion were coming too close to the space station for comfort, and if they would actually hit, the lifeboat should immediately take off. And among those astronauts, there were actually 3 Russian cosmonauts. So in a sense, by shooting up their own satellite, they also endangered 3 of their own cosmonauts. So that's kind of an illustration that in that sense, humanity is all in the same boat, which is, of course, the best, you know, baseline to then come to certain agreements. Well, maybe we shouldn't start shooting up not even our own satellites by way of target practicing. Maybe we should agree on common global guidelines on how to behave in space in such a manner that debris is not created, or at least not created more than is unavoidable. And even go one step further then, I'll stop there, but even one step further and say, let's agree on starting to take out our own dead satellites before they create more damage than they might already have done.
That was Frans van der Dunk on making law for space. This is Worldview for Engelsberg Ideas, funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. I'm Adam Bolton. The producer is Marie Jessel, assistant producer Eve Webster, and sound engineer Gareth Jones. Thank you for listening.